And we are live. This is Dark Journalist. It's great to be here with everyone. This is X Series episode 47, and we're going to be looking very hardcore at the Hot Zone. Of course, as usual, I'm joined by the lovely Olivia.
Hi, everybody.
And tonight's a very special episode because the Hot Zone forms kind of a crucial angle in our research at the present time. And what we're looking at in relation to the Hot Zone is all kinds of information coming in from many different sources that this exploration of the Hot Zone, which is an area that lies beneath the waves of the Caribbean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean, is between the island of Bimini and Cuba, the western tip of Cuba, and stretches all the way out to the tip of Yucatan. Now, this particular zone, I've gotten a lot of information about that from a number of people who are contractors in oceanography and going about underground looking for different types of anomalies or mapping the ocean floor. So what I've heard from them is that there's an area down there that stretches from sort of off the coast of Miami there, all the way over to Bimini, as I described. And what's happening is when they go down there, if they see certain things like ruins, they're not allowed to photograph them or mention them when they're done. And one of the terms that I heard for this section of ocean bottom is called the Hot Zone. Now, when we've connected that up in various episodes, we've gotten into the work of Paulina Zielitzki, who was an incredible engineer who went in and discovered off the western tip of Cuba an underwater city in 2001. Now, this story hit the mainstream media and was widely shared because it was kind of one of those stories you just couldn't avoid. But over time, a lot of misinformation about the story crept in, and in the mainstream media, they were able to tamp it down. So we're going to get deep tonight into what exactly was happening there in the Hot Zone. But we're also going to show how NASA's activities, where the Hot Zone lies, are very, very active and have been for over 60 years. And some of the things we're going to get into tonight are explosive and are covered now and can be linked to public sources as well as private sources. So we're going to have quite a lot of fun with that tonight. As Olivia can tell you, I've been very excited about this one. Being episode 47, you know, I think that we've struck a big balance in the X steganography series where we search for these symbols and this kind of nomenclature that is shared in secret government agencies regarding X, literally the term X. And just a quick recap on that, I've been able to discern about 200 some odd instances where a project in aerospace that was secret went black and then came back with a different moniker, in this case X. And we have the entire system of X planes that were secret, which in the 60s were secret and now still hold the records for the space planes for manned flight, which is quite odd considering it's 50 years later. You'd think there'd be something completely different going on. But there we are. So after tracking it through government agencies and sort of doing that type of investigation, I started to realize that the X steganography, tracked back through history and through the work of the mystery schools, holding this information, tracking down this information, passing down this information. So we're going to get into how the X steganography fits into what is going on there in this Hot Zone area and how there's a geopolitical situation brewing, which is pretty off the charts. And everybody seems to be clamoring in to the Hot Zone to get at what? To get at this X factor. The X factor apparently at the ocean bottom relates to a former civilization, according to the work of people like Edgar Cayce, from Edgar Cayce to Graham Hancock. This is related to the civilization of Atlantis, which is quite powerful in the sense that Cayce's version of Atlantis and the mystery school version of Atlantis from Theosophy and Anthroposophy is that we have a very extensive history there of an advanced culture, and that this culture sank beneath the waves about 10,000 BC, which would totally rewrite history. And then with the discovery off Cuba, of course, everyone links this to Atlantis, and they should. But I will say also that there appears to be now in the research done by Egerton Sykes, who was one of the premier Atlantologists, and really, I think we need to go far more back into his archives to figure out what was going on there. We're going to get into Egerton tonight. We did touch on him a few times in previous episodes, but never as deep as we're going to tonight. Of course, we're going to be taking your questions in the second half of the program. Write them all in caps. Olivia is going to be taking those questions and putting them together into kind of a cogent narrative. So we really try to keep them focused on the hot zone. If you would, I know there's a lot going on in the world, and we have all kinds of political hay going on. But I figure for now, for tonight, it's enough that we know that the world's going crazy out there. And
we're going to steer clear of politics tonight and any kind of cult activity tonight.
Exactly. Cult report will be put on. But I do think it's interesting because, of course, when you get into the steganography and the hot zone work, the hot zone is at the very heart of major geopolitics and has been for years, specifically with Cuba. And we're going to get into why that is tonight with some very unusual facts. And I always like to start out, Miss Olivia, with what I call a TKO. Why not start this show out with a TKO?
Please do.
So one thing that struck me as very, very odd was a story that I ran across, which was a completely legitimate media source and was just from files, Cuban intelligence files that had come out over time after Castro died. And the headline was, Fidel Castro recruited former Nazi SS members to train troops during Cuban Missile Crisis. Actually, I inserted former. It just says Nazi SS members, which is interesting. Fidel Castro recruited former members of the Nazi Waffen SS to train his troops at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, declassified German intelligence files show. Now, this is a very unusual story, and it's made its way through various media outlets, and it's out there. It's definitely an established fact. Now, how unusual is this that we have an ultra left wing leader, Castro, at the height of the Cold War, you know, claiming that he's this major communist 90 miles off the shore of Miami, and here he is going to Nazis to back up his fight against the U.S. The communist leader also sought to buy weapons from arms dealers connected with Germany's extreme right. Now, how does that make any sense? First of all, it would be against their entire Cuban revolutionary statement, because they would never deal, one, with former Nazis, two, they would never deal with hard right elements. After all, they're a major leftist organization, a major communist ideology. So where does this story come from? Papers released this week by the BND, a German foreign intelligence agency, show information gathered by German operatives 50 years ago during the tense days of the Cuban Missile Crisis. They reveal that Castro personally approved a plan to hire former Nazi officers to instruct the Cuban Revolutionary Army. Now, this is very strange because, of course, the Russians at the time are backing Castro, and they're the ones who put the missiles in there. And we know that the Russians and the Nazis didn't exactly get along. I mean, when you kill 20 million people back and forth, there's going to be a lot of enmity there. What are these Nazis doing helping training Cuban troops? What are they doing there in the first place? They reveal that Castro personally approved a plan to hire former Nazi officers, offering them wages that were four times the average salary they were getting in Germany at the time. This is remarkable. The papers dating from October 62 show that four former officers from the elite Nazi death squads had been invited to the Cuban capital through subsequent reports could only confirm the two had arrived. It has also showed the Castro regime negotiated with two traffickers linked with Germany's far right to purchase Belgian-made arms. Very, very unusual. But I thought about a story that took place right during the Cuban Missile Crisis and has always been kind of shrouded in mystery. And it's all about Operation Ortsak. Now, Operation Ortsak was a plan to take the island of Cuba if all else had failed in negotiations. But I always thought the name was weird, and it was explained away later as, ha, 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 it was Castro backwards. But it didn't quite sit well with me. And this strange report about Nazi collaboration with the Cubans really struck me as unusual. And I went back to thinking about the name of this, and I tried to figure out how they got the name of this in the first place. And it was a word of mouth because they didn't commit the activity to paper. There's no classified document about Orszag. So I went back looking, trying to find matches for this name. Oddly enough, it's a German name. And one of the most famous people with the name Orszag or Orszag is Maria Orszag, who was a German Nazi clairvoyant who worked with the Vril Society. So,
all right, let's see your picture again.
No, that's not Gigi Young. That's Maria Orszag. It is quite remarkable because I think what we're getting there, what is this uncovering of this mystery just hanging out there? Because of course it would have been incredibly stupid to have an operation named the backwards name of the dictator, then they would know exactly what it was all about. But I always thought the name was unusual anyway. And I think that we have something there which we're tracking more and more into now, which is the Nazi influence in Cuba. And I found some other influences in Cuba that are quite unusual that I think we need to get into to get a full picture. But the off-the-charts realization and revelation that Castro was hiring former Nazi death squad operators to help him in his Cuban revolution to fight the Americans is very, very unusual, especially since they were, at that time, a Soviet satellite. Most peculiar. We're going to incorporate all of this tonight as we go along, but keep it in mind because I think it does lend some credence to the idea that it's more than just nuclear missiles that are at stake in Cuba, which is, you know, very unusual too. If there was going to be a nuclear flashpoint, we already had it in Berlin. So this idea of placing missiles in Cuba always bothered me in the first place. It was obviously going to be detected. So the whole playground around the Cuban Missile Crisis, it brought the world to the brink of nuclear war. There's no question about it. But there's a lot of unanswered questions about exactly what was going on there. And I think it comes into play as we take a deeper look. Now, we also have TKO2. How about two KOs? Two TKOs.
That sounds great.
All right. Conclusive proof now that Gordon Cooper was sent on a mission to review magnetic anomalies in the hot zone from space under the guise of the idea that they might be a nuclear submarine base underground. But that actual idea doesn't hold up. However, searching for magnetic anomalies in the hot zone plays very strongly into what we've been seeing in relation to hot zone activity. And we're going to get deep into that tonight because a Cooper's role becomes remarkable. And then this whole story about Cooper and his spying, basically, on the hot zone for the Americans from space gets exploited and twisted into a Spanish galleon TV show. And that mutation from a solid report and his very unusual activities into a strange let's hunt for Spanish galleons TV show is quite remarkable. And we're going to get into that tonight. Of course, Cooper was remarkable and he was an American hero. And, you know, he did 22 orbits around the Earth, which is still the record for any astronaut. So he really was the top man in the program. And he was a part of the Mercury, the Gemini, and the Apollo programs. So his background is completely untouchable. What's also fascinating about him is he pushed very hard later in life for UFO disclosure, including a dramatic letter to the UN requesting that we acknowledge the presence of off-world civilization visitors and how he had, you know, witnessed these things and how he knew other people in high places also were aware of this phenomenon. Now, Cooper, when he was a pilot doing trainings in the 40s over Germany and Europe, these things would just follow him, the kind of Foo Fighter formations. And so he was very much on the record about it. And he also drew what was a UFO film that was handed to him in the late 50s, where when he handed it over, it just sort of disappeared. But these were people who were part of his team who had filmed a UFO land on a dry lake bed in Oregon. Very fascinating story. So a couple of key points I took from a few articles, one of them from Express in the UK, and another one also from the UK newspaper, The Sun. Now, I double-checked the facts with other sources because we know sometimes, like the American reports, the UK reports can get off the charts. But these were very interesting. Here's just a snapshot of, I think, the key points of this article, which comes to us from August of 2018, when the story suddenly vanished shortly after that. It's quite explosive before that, but we're going to get into the whole thing tonight, so we won't miss any of it. I'm going to remind everyone that you're watching The Dark Journalist Show. We're here for episode 47 of the X series. We're going deep into NASA's hunt for Atlantis in the hot zone with the help of Gordon Cooper. People may not ordinarily associate Cooper with the hunt for Atlantis, but after tonight, we definitely will. And we have a fantastic crowd tonight. I want to remind everyone to go to darkjournalist.com and sign up for the newsletter. And this is really a kind of a fantastic way for us to keep in touch with each other. The kind of censorship that's being performed on the social media platforms shows us the wave that is coming in, and it's not very pretty.
You want to talk about what YouTube is doing?
Yes, yes. Well, you go ahead.
Well, I mean, we know that they've always been unsubscribing people, but now it has massive. Been amped up.
Oh, yeah. They've been massively unsubscribing people from channels like mine, and certainly from my channel. But what they're also doing is censoring content across the board. Pinterest announced today that they were censoring anything that had to do with vaccines in order to prevent misinformation from becoming the norm. Well, you have to start with the pharmaceutical companies if you're going to block misinformation, because they're the biggest purveyors of it. But this is the wave that we're looking at, and that's the way it goes with social media platforms. There's no guarantee, and when the shutdown comes, you know, when they roll out some patsy who supposedly is a conspiracy theorist or a Q person, then they'll use it as an excuse to try to clamp down on the alternative media. There's no question about it. And they're already on the border of doing this. So make sure that we stay in touch. Sign up for the newsletter. That gives us a pipeline directly to each other with no intermediary, which I think is crucial. But while the platforms are here, hey, we're going to use them for all they're worth. And I like YouTube as much as the next person. And I like using it. Okay, so let's get Cooper in mind. Cooper, you know, when you study Cooper's history, Gordon Cooper's, I was giving some of his accolades there. This is after he had achieved this kind of remarkable orbit. And, you know, Kennedy is really giving him top billing, and he's known as a Kennedy insider as far as the astronauts go. There's a couple of them, like Glenn and like Cooper, who are real Kennedy people, and some who are more wed to other factions. But Kennedy and Cooper had this tight bond and tight link, and Kennedy tried to get him to be the consummate American hero, which he was, and get him betrayed that way. Now, years later, after his service as an astronaut and after he helped some other Apollo missions, he went into his own companies, and there were always these stories about Cooper, very interesting stories, that while he was up there, he had been doing secret missions for NASA as well, which is why he was up there 22 times and other guys weren't. And part of that was about observing this area of the hot zone that we've been describing there in the Bahamas. Now, what is interesting about all this for me is that although the excuse is given that when they've done these media reports as they've come out, and they've come out fairly recently, they're saying, well, you know, this was related to the Cold War and they're looking for these sub bases. However, that type of equipment wasn't really available at the time. So what they could have been doing was mapping areas and looking for anomalies in the hot zone and looking for magnetic anomalies in the hot zone, which is what they say he was doing. But they say it was for nuclear purposes. Let's deconstruct it a little bit. There is no precedent in these classified documents for searching in the hot zone for ancient artifacts or for ancient culture. They've allowed it to run as code, as steganography. It is not the kind of thing that we have a smoking gun document. We do have smoking gun documents, however, that the CIA was doing things like reviewing Casey's material on Atlantis in relation to the Sphinx, and how if there might be a Hall of Records in underneath the Sphinx based on the Casey readings. That's a 1964 record that we have of the CIA putting that out. If that's 64, and he's up here in 62 and 63, looking down from space at the hot zone, then I think we can tie these things together and say these intelligence agencies were looking in the hot zone for these magnetic anomalies as they related to unusual activity and as they related to a sunken culture. But one of the things about this culture that I wanted to kind of emphasize about this is that, in my opinion, we're not just looking for the Mayans that went down under the water. We're talking about, according to accounts as vast as Plato and Steiner and Casey, an incredibly advanced culture that possesses advanced technology and literally caused a gigantic inundation in an area by using a particular effect, which was hidden through mystery schools years later so no one would get their hands back on it. And that so many of the push and pull that we see in the 20th and the 21st century over secret technology relates directly to this advanced technology and the effect that it creates. Many of the things that happen in relation to the UFO file and all the massive sightings of UFOs in the hot zone also bear this out. Why is that area such an incredible hotbed of UFO activity? Obviously, these things are all linked. Now, in this show, I use the term as kind of a blanket term called apotheum. It's A-P-O-T-H-E-U-M. This describes an effect that is reached and happened when they used a certain type of technology. The apotheum is also the effect that we see when UFOs enter the space. They introduce a kind of a runaway physics. And we have all kinds of things like cars failing and power stations going out and, you know, after they land, plants won't grow there, whatever it happens to be, complete disruption of the normal electromagnetic field. Many of the things that we've studied in relation to CERN also lend themselves to this apotheum effect, which I believe that they're trying to recreate there and capture. But in any case, when I use that term, I want everyone to understand what it is. For me, the apotheum is exactly what's being guarded in the UFO file. It's not merely the idea that we're being visited by some off-world culture. And I think that's kind of crucial. But I think to get the answer to what kind of effect we're talking about, we have to look at things like the Bermuda Triangle. We have to look at unusual things where planes and ships disappear off radar and nobody knows what's going on. And we have to look to those cases where people have survived that and come back to tell us about it, or whistleblowers have come out to tell us about it, as I've heard these stories about the hot zone. These things are going to be kind of the crucial linchpin understandings for us to go forward to figure out exactly what's going on down there. Now, what's interesting is there are records, some of the earliest records of this effect around the hot zone come from Columbus himself. And Columbus, as I've pointed out in a number of reports, and we're going to get back to Cooper, but this will all segue together, I promise. One of the things we have to keep in mind about Columbus is that he's not just an explorer. He is deeply linked with the mystery schools. He's the one who possesses the ancient maps that Pereiris would reproduce later that show Antarctica with no ice. This is a major mystery school insider. And he's connected, though, through the Templars. And he actually flies Templar flags when he's heading over to America. Also, in the work, in the interviews I've done with Dr. Joseph Farrell, we've had some very interesting conversations about how there's no question that Columbus was over here far before 1492. And as we know from people doing this Hooked X Templar searches and looking for these Knights Templars, we have those in America as early as the 12th century. So there's a whole relationship between the mystery schools moving this over here to America. One of the things that connects Columbus directly to the exsteganography is something that still puzzles historians. I'm going to point it out here real briefly. This is what Columbus signed. It's very unusual occult signature that he signed with exsteganography embedded in it on the Pope's grave. After he passed away, Columbus made this signature, and he used these very unusual X's, which people still don't know what they mean, and the general, this is not his normal signature. Whatever he was up to here has baffled historians, and they think it's some kind of steganography. Now, the exsteganography here suggests Columbo is stating in the open because his signature on the Pope's grave, at the Pope's funeral, is going to be news everywhere. That's like, you know, a royal wedding or something. Now, it's a massive event. It's the Super Bowl of the period. For him to do this unusual signature gives his position away, which is that he's declaring that he's part of, he's in the linkage of that exsteganography. And he's also signaling somewhere that he is in association with the mystery school knowledge. We'll find a number of accounts of Columbus in relation to this come up with him and these very unusual mystery school connections. For now, let's look at the strange things that got reported on his trip here to America. Okay, so the famous Columbus diary, and it's this log that is kept there of Columbus's travels. So here's a couple of unusual things that suggest he was seeing something very unusual as he was coming toward the hot zone. Quote, they sailed that day and night 27 leagues and a few more on their route west, heading toward the Caribbean. And on this night at the beginning of it, they saw a marvelous branch of fire fall from the sky into the sea, distant from them 4 or 5 leagues. Then there's a second strange light. Now this one happens on October 11th, 1492. Quote, directly from the diary. After sunset, he, Columbus, steered on his former course to the west. They made about 12 miles each hour, and until 2 hours after midnight made about 90 miles, which is 22 leagues and a half. And because the caravel Pinta was a better sailor and went ahead of the Admiral Columbus, it found land and made signals that the Admiral had ordered. A sailor named Rodrigo de Triana saw this land first. They're seeing land appear before they expect it. Although the admiral at the 10th hour of the night, while he was on the stern castle, saw a light, it was something so faint that he did not wish to affirm that it was land. But he called Gutierrez, the steward of the king, and told him that there seemed to be a light, and for him to look, and thus he did and saw it. He also said, and so on. Now they're all seeing these lights, and it looks like they're lights off land, and they assume, okay, we're heading into land here. After the admiral said it, it was seen once or twice again. This was his description. It was like a small wax candle that rose and lifted up, which to a few seemed to be an indication of land. So back then they're looking at it and they're saying, looks like candles in the distance. But the admiral was certain that they were near land because of which when they recited the salve, which sailors in their own way are accustomed to recite and sing, all being present, the admiral entreated and admonished them to keep a good lookout for the forecastle and to carefully watch for land. That's how convinced they were heading into land. As they get closer, the light goes away, the land goes away. Now, very interestingly, there's a whistleblower from AUTEC. And Olivia, I'm going to ask you for that in about a minute and a half.
I have it queued up.
Okay, I played this one, and we're going to play it here. And it's going to relate to another story of someone who witnessed the same thing. But in any case, I want to play it as a backdrop for this and then go back to Columbus's compass problem. Okay, go for it.
Okay.
My name is Kurt Rollett. I'm a former AUTEC employee. On one evening, we pulled out of the dock here. Suddenly, out of nowhere, we had a radar contact pop up directly in front of our ship that appeared to be a landmass where no landmass should exist.
Okay, so this gentleman worked inside of AUTEC, which is, for all intents and purposes, our underwater Area 51, which is right off of Andros Island, which, by the way, is very close to Bimini. And there's a lot of ruins that are seen around Andros, too, including something called the Andros Platform. That's all in the hot zone. And AUTEC is right in the middle of the hot zone. And a lot of people are very wary of the experiments that they're doing. But it doesn't come as any big surprise that we have a group like this down there. What I do find very interesting about that is that he's not saying I saw a big object. He's saying I saw land appearing. That's how it shows up on a radar. Even Columbus's people thought they were seeing land out of nowhere. Now there's another lieutenant commander who gave testimony.
Can I interrupt? Yeah. Could it possibly be a time slip?
It is interesting. It is so interesting to think about that. And actually, if we get through this part, let's come back to that question, because it is really, it does get into that.
I'm breaking your attention. Sorry.
Actually, no, I would just say this in relation to Columbus. Mm-hmm. He kind of, you know, he thinks it's very unusual. He calls it almost like a ghost island, that it appeared and then disappeared.
Do you have a theory as to what it is?
I think, well, the testimony I'm just about to get into about this lieutenant commander in 76 came forward on a couple of documentaries. And he said, you know, he and his captain were going in. They'd been in that area hundreds of times. He's been something like 150 times in the Bermuda Triangle. He understands the area quite well. But this was late at night, past midnight, and they're seeing on the radar a large landmass out of nowhere. And this is more in the Bermuda Triangle part. And it's interesting because I want to point out that the Bermuda Triangle and the hot zone are different places, but they are oh so close together. So let's take a look at this. Here, the Bermuda Triangle with Bermuda, Puerto Rico, Jamaica. You know, we have this whole area here where these ships disappear and where literally planes go down and they're never found, and also where people have all kinds of magnetic disturbances, etc. That's what these people are reporting. The hot zone has a little piece inside the Bermuda Triangle, but it comes forward here, and it's right between, these are the two major spots, Bimini, the Cuba ruins, and the tip of Yucatan. So it's that line there. So these things are very closely related. Now, this lieutenant commander who came forward said the ship itself started to go awry and the electrical circuits started to go strangely. The engine started to freak out and they themselves started to feel weird feelings in their chest and throat in the presence of this emerging landmass. As they got closer, they shined out the light on this and the more they shined out the light, it looked like a huge gray, he couldn't even say what it was, but it was like, it was almost metallic. And he said it stretched so far up that when you took the light all the way up, it just kept going. So this thing just appears there. And at that point, the captain says, I don't care to investigate what this is. Try any way you can to get us out of here. But he was very adamant about it. And it sounds so much like what we have from the AUTEC whistleblower. So this landmass, it's not just like, hey, there's a UFO. Isn't that interesting? This is an entire mass that shows up and then sort of dominates the environment. And then what starts to happen, all these apotheum effects, the electricity goes weird. Even their physical bodies are affected. So we're looking at something that when it appears, it's interfering. It's introducing a different kind of physics to our regular physical environment. And therefore, it's giving us a really major issue. And when we hear about people disappearing, you know, we've also heard these pilots who go in through these clouds. Some of the people who've kind of made it out of the Bermuda Triangle, they go into these vortexes and they come out the other side. They will describe it. They'll say like, well, it was kind of like a weird mustard cloud, you know, mustard colored, almost yellow green cloud going round and round and round. And when I came out the other side, you know, I thought it was 5 minutes and it was 30 minutes. So, and also their gas, you know, the fuel had not been expired and things like that. So completely unexplainable. And that's why when we get around the Bermuda Triangle, nobody has any real good answers, except we know it's very dangerous. Now, at the same time, over and over again, we've got ships and planes that go through there all the time and nothing happens. So what is it that causes the difference? It obviously has something to do with timing.
There's such good theories going on right now.
I'm so happy to hear one. Go ahead.
Well, Scruples 4444 says, what if Atlantis cloaking tech is glitchy and sometimes fails? And Thorough Lost in Snow said, or it's accidental. If the stone meltdown caused a runaway apotheum effect, it could be efforts to make it back or just blips windows of overlap.
Oh, that's
and that makes me think of that fantastic episode of Star Trek that we always talk about. Why do I always forget the name of this episode?
The Tholian Web.
The Tholian Web, where there's windows.
They're caught in interphase, which is a real scientific theorem. That in between the dimensions, there's an interphase that takes place. And this could very well be, I haven't even, you know, I'm actually even leaving the more spookier dimensional stuff out.
Don't do it. Bring it back in.
Well, even, I mean, as far out as this report sounds, it's all very grounded in historical record and historical facts. So, but then we're gonna enlarge it as we go along. Let's read this now. Again, more unusualness from Columbus heading into the hot zone. He's going into the Caribbean, having some problems. He had an issue with his compass during the voyage. Now, it's September 17th, 1492. Quote, this is directly from his diary, which is written by his shipmate. He's asked to keep an account of the entire voyage. The pilots took the north, marking it. The pilots took a sight on the North Star and compared it with the compass bearing and found that the compasses northwested a full point, 11 and a quarter degrees, and the sailors were fearful and depressed and did not say why, because they realized their compass isn't working. The admiral was aware of this, and he ordered that the north again be marked when dawn came. They found that the compasses somehow were correct when dawn came. The cause was the North Star appears to move and not the compasses. On the 14th of September, he, Columbus, was astonished to find that the magnetic needle and their compasses did not point exactly to the polar star, but varied toward the west. And as they proceeded, this variation increased. This new phenomenon filled the companions of Columbus with terror. Yeah, you have no way, there's no directional theory that can help you if your compass is gone. Especially back then. Nature itself seemed to have sustained a change, and the only guide they had left to point them to a safe retreat from an unbounded and trackless ocean was about to fail them. Columbus, with no less quickness than ingenuity, assigned a reason for this appearance, which, though it did not satisfy himself, seemed plausible to them, and it dispelled their fears and silenced their murmurs. Finally, in this Washington Irving account. Washington Irving published a well-known biography of Columbus. On the 13th of September, this is a quote from Irving's account, in the evening, being about 200 leagues from the island of Faro, Columbus for the first time noticed the variation of the compass needle, a phenomenon which had never before been remarked. He perceived about nightfall that the needle, instead of pointing to the North Star, varied about half a point, or between 5 and 6 degrees to the northwest, still more on the following morning. Struck with the circumstance, he observed it attentively for 3 days and found that the variation increased as he advanced. So as he's going, the compass is becoming more and more useless. He's heading right into the hot zone. Now, he at first made no mention of this phenomenon, knowing how ready the people were to take alarm, but it soon attracted the attention of the pilots and filled them with consternation. It seemed as if the very laws of nature were changing as they advanced, and that they were entering another world subject to unknown influences. And this is remarkable. This is how they're telling us from 1492. They apprehended that the compass was about to lose its mysterious virtues, and without this guide, what was to become of them in a vast and trackless ocean? So basically, Columbus makes up a story in order to kind of calm them down, but he never is able to explain what happened out there. Now, what's interesting is so many of the reports, when you get into the Bermuda Triangle, lead us into this whole thing. But we have the history all the way back from the foundation of discovery, the discovery of America. They're having problems when they enter into this zone somewhere between the Bermuda Triangle and the hot zone. So now we have a story about astronaut Gordon Cooper being assigned by NASA to observe the hot zone from space to find magnetic anomalies. And what he's finding are very unusual anomalies that will form the foundation of stories that he kept maps after he left the service of NASA. And he had an incredible memory, so he would keep track of the coordinates in his head. And he became very, very interested in doing expeditions throughout the hot zone to observe these things. Now, it's stated by treasure hunters who are now doing TV shows and sensationalizing it, that these were all about Spanish galleons and wrecks, and actually related to some of the boats that Columbus lost when he hit this zone. I'm sure that anyone interested in that end of things would certainly, you know, if he saw something like that, would find it interesting. But it seems to me that the entire mission that Gordon Cooper is on for NASA, supposedly looking for magnetic anomalies that relate to nuclear bases, is not really the full story. And that if we go into it understanding the pressures based on the stories that we've told about Hemingway and his own expeditions looking for something under the water, and them sighting the Cuba ruins in the 50s, the ruins off of the western tip of Cuba, we're getting into a whole different insight about it. Remember, about five episodes ago, we went into the fact that there was nearly a national security incident, which is recorded, where the Attorney General, the President, and the CIA Director are all together with a covert operations missions officer. And they are describing a major event that's to take place at Ernest Hemingway's villa in Cuba. Now, Kennedy historians have never been able to explain exactly what that is. Arthur Schlesinger, who was the closest to the family, when he's asked about it, says, I have no idea. So, you know, they floated ideas out there like, oh, they were going to assassinate Castro at Hemingway's villa. No, you know, that's not what it is. So we have gone into how Hemingway kept a capsule there at the villa, and that after his death, or after he had to flee Cuba and then died, that the capsule was still there, and that the Kennedy administration made brave efforts to get it out and finally did. So we're looking at something very unusual in relation to what's happening around Cuba. And now we've introduced some other elements which show that Castro was hiring former Nazi death squad operators. Now, there's a certain amount of political intrigue around the story of Cuba anyway, of course, because of the revolution, because of the pressure of the mafia, and because of the political pressures. But this seems to go a heck of a lot deeper, because that doesn't really explain why they have Cooper doing these 22 revolutions around the planet and staring down at the hot zone for anomalies. In any case, Cooper goes on, and it becomes understood that he's done some unusual work and has a lot of unusual interests, including UFOs. Now, he does his own expeditions in the hot zone, and they are later thought of, and people will say, oh, he's interested in these Spanish galleons. Now, there's a TV show on the Discovery Network about Cooper's treasures, and it's about this map that came out of nowhere, which is associated with some of the things that Gordon Cooper left after he died. And the map was supposed to be about Spanish galleons, and they've got everyone on the show rooting for this idea that this explorer guy who knew Cooper very loosely, and I think they've exaggerated that contact, but what they've done is they've really hyped up this thing. And in one of the clips, he goes, we could find $1.2 billion worth of gold, you know, and they're going this gold thing and all the rest of it. But in truth, what Cooper was looking for, the information that we have is about magnetic anomalies. Think about it. A magnetic anomaly is what set off Columbus's compass. Magnetic anomaly in that area may also explain the presence of Cape Canaveral in Florida, for example, and the fact that we have an incredible NASA presence supposedly studying geomagnetic waves in the ocean. I'm sure there's some truth to that, but obviously it's a good cover if you're looking for something else. Now, there's an awful lot of intrigue in relation to this, but I think what's important is that with the TV show and with this kind of thing about Spanish galleons, they've covered over the very, very unusual story of Cooper looking for these anomalies. So let's read just a little bit about what he was up to. I'm going to remind everyone you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. It's great to have so many people here. I know we've got Carly from Dimensions.
Actually, Carly had to go to bed.
Well, she's in the UK.
But Gigi's with us.
Gigi, it's great to have Gigi Young out there. We're going to have Gigi back on the show shortly. She and I are conspiring in the background on a very important topic. And one of the things about tonight's episode that is important, I think, is that as we go further into the hot zone activity, I want to tell you that the people I'm speaking with about it are some of the best researchers that have been involved in the hot zone and have been involved around this type of research. And we're going to be bringing them forward over the next couple of months. And the hot zone is going to be a much, well, the whole thing is going to be much better understood, I say, from the point of view that these people, as I've spoken to them off the record, and they're going to go on the record, it's going to be quite remarkable the things that they bring forward in relation to this. So we're all very excited to hear about what we're getting in terms of the information on the hot zone and also the feedback from everyone out there. I'm just amazed, not only in relation to the X-Steganography, but in general, I think people have really been providing an excellent backdrop for some of the stuff that we've been getting, Miss Olivia.
Contiki Man wanted to know, are you referring to the vile vortices mapped by Ivan T. Anderson?
Well, Anderson comes up a lot, and you know, I would say that his work does indeed crisscross with a lot of this. Comes in directly through the work of our friend who wrote The Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings. We did a whole episode on Charles Hapgood. This is a remarkable book. He went back and found that there were many maps that included Antarctica without ice, that included land between Africa and South America, and that somehow what we have to keep track of is there's a group somewhere in ancient times that had this amazing information relating to the geography of the planet, which they wouldn't have been able to do. And most of it, we haven't been able to do ourselves until the last century. So where did all that advanced knowledge come from? Well, it's very interesting because even the Piraeus map is drawn from this whole period of time. 1513 is the map, but supposedly the map went back to the Library of Alexandria. So we're looking at groups that kept the knowledge, kept the information. I remember very well this story about Jonathan Swift and the moons of Mars. So somewhere there's a group that seems to know about astronomy. They seem to know about the mapping of the Earth. They seem to know about the positions of the continents in ancient times. And those people, we have little traces of them. We refer to them here as mystery schools and mystery school players. But it's quite fascinating because their tracks throughout history are very easy to see. I mean, as with the Piraeus map, showing Antarctica as a continent without ice on it. There's also incredible maps from 1737 from France, from Bouache. And his maps show Antarctica as well. So this is another anomaly. He's 200 years after Piraeus. And he's also showing these land masses between Africa and South America. So what we have is a rich tradition in seafaring cultures understanding this. But look, Columbus was one of the ultimate explorers of the period, and he was deeply connected with the mystery schools, as we demonstrated earlier. And if somebody's going to fly Templar flags, 100 years after their main Templar leaders are killed, then that's somebody who was willing to take a chance, since it was the Pope who had burned them at the stake. So the way that I look at it is, you know, we're starting to come upon information that I think is going to lead us to the conclusion that there's been a group guiding the release of this information over time, and that some of these things, like the Parerese map, for example, and like the work of Charles Hapgood and Ivan Sanderson, those guys would come along in the 60s and decipher a lot of this. Remember this in relation to the Parerese map, and you might just think, hey, we're talking about an interesting map. Eisenhower, on the prompting of Hapgood, nearly caused an international incident with Spain trying to get the Parerese map in 1958. Why would you do that? Who would care about a map? Why would you put such pressure on the Spanish government? We had a man very high up in the State Department named Harry Stinson, who was just adamant on getting this map, the original copy that the Parerese was drawn from, not the Parerese map, which had come forward in 1929, but the original map it was drawn from, which was a much larger map, and it was the original Columbus map. And there were spies, basically, who said, that's in the Spanish archives. And so Hapgood got the information and brought it to Eisenhower, and Eisenhower moves forward and tries to pressure the Spanish government to give it to us. It's quite unusual. And for me, considering all the activity around the hot zone, I think it relates very strongly to hot zone activity and to Antarctica. And I think that those two secrets, as we see Nazi expeditions to Central America with the Ananurba, which is a family ancestry, a cultural ancestry group going around the world before World War II, looking for the Aryan race and the roots of the Aryan race. And, you know, the Nazis are looking for Atlantis in Tibet. They're looking for Atlantis in Central America. So they're very hot on this case. When they show back up in leftist Cuba supporting the Cuban Revolution, it's very unusual because they're ultra-right wing. So we have to kind of take a wide-angle lens, I think, when we view these things, just to get a better handle on it. Okay, so let's get to the facts of the article about Cooper. That was a great question, by the way. Everyone asked the second part of the show, we're going to take questions. I think we're doing pretty well on time. We're doing well. And in about 20 minutes, we'll start taking your questions. If you're watching the Dark Journalist Show, please go to darkjournalist.com. Sign up for the newsletter. Keep us in touch. My God, with the social media censorship, it's off the charts. And I cannot emphasize to you enough how much they are stifling and censoring people in relation to a number of different subjects, a lot of them political, but it also gets into anything that starts to challenge the dominant paradigm. You're out, you know. Twitter and Zuckerberg and all those guys have gotten together, and they've had those meetings at Davos, and they've realized, hey, if we let people really express themselves, we're in for trouble, so let's censor the whole pack. So that's why we need you to sign up for the newsletter. Stay in touch with us. And that creates a pipeline so that we can just tell you once a week what shows are coming up and what exciting events are coming up. And I have to say that, and I don't say this lightly, we have some of the most exciting events coming up this year that we have ever had in relation to the Dark Journalist Show and the type of output that we have. So we're gonna do some very special things there this year. Yes.
A couple people were asking about Carmen Bolter.
Oh, yes. Well, Carmen,
it's been a while.
She's in Spain. She's doing some remarkable work there and some remarkable research. You know, Carmen is not much of a grandstander, but she gets a lot of work done in the background. And you can bet very well that if she's in Spain, she's doing some side scan activity and some archaeology there. And we will definitely have her back on the show. We haven't had her on in maybe over a year, but she's a crucial part
of
this.
She's wonderful.
And she's putting together a documentary series called New Atlantis. So this is an incredible tie-in. I am blown away by the amount of books coming out in relation to people like Andrew Collins, Greg and Laura Little are doing a book on Atlantis. America Before by Graham Hancock is coming out. Everyone is starting. There's something that's happening here that's almost like they realize the time is upon us, and they're all looking at it from these different angles. And here we are, right perched there in the hot zone, which is where I think the epicenter of the entire research will take us. Okay, Gordon Cooper from the article direct. Cooper successfully piloted the Mercury Atlas 9 Faith 7 spacecraft around the Earth 22 times in 63, paving the way for men to reach the moon. Pivotal year that Kennedy was assassinated. He was a pioneer who became the first American to sleep in space and first to fly twice. He was also the first American televised from space. But as well as researching the limits of human endurance, he was also charged with a secret spy mission while in orbit. Using a special long-range detection equipment, Cooper was asked by the U.S. government to look for nuclear threats of Russian submarines and nuclear missile sites. Now, what's interesting is the guy who's doing the Cooper's treasure thing is one of these guys who searched for shipwrecks, and his dad knew Cooper. And he says here that Cooper was an avid treasure hunter and noted the positions of Caribbean shipwrecks when he conducted the spy mission and created a map on his return to Earth. As I said, he was noted for a remarkable memory. And this idea that he was mapping out coordinates for the government in relation to magnetic anomalies in the hot zone sits much better with me thinking about that than thinking about him looking for nuclear threats from space. The shipwreck hunter, this guy named Miklos, claims Cooper gave him the maps, which included detailed charts and exact coordinates. I can tell you this, that Cooper's wife had a number of these charts and things. And what I think happened is that when he went to her and said, can I have those maps, he got some of them. In the first season of the show, Miklos and his team used Cooper's map to make a remarkable discovery in the Caribbean. Blah, blah, Spanish galleons, whatever. Okay. But with the latest discovery, the Californian is conscious of being labeled crazy by coming out with a wild claim that Cooper's map might now have led him to an alien spaceship submerged under the ocean. I kid you not. Now, it's very interesting.
What are you reading from?
This is from the Sun article. No, the Express article here. It's Alien Hunter claims he has found ET spaceship under Bermuda Triangle. Yeah. And this, the article actually came through in August, but it went completely flat. And I think the reason is the show is oriented around Spanish galleons. That's what they're looking for. And then this seemed to me an unusual piece that he was picking up here. But anyway, let's keep rolling. With his latest discovery, he said he's found this very large anomaly under there, and he's gone in one of these submersibles around it. He says he wants to remain neutral until he can investigate the mysterious site further. Miklos and TV production company Ample Entertainment are hoping the Discovery Channel will commission a third season of Cooper's Treasure. Now, you have to understand a couple of things are happening. TV loves to, just think of Ancient Aliens, they love to exploit a subject and pump it up. But I'll tell you what is real in this story. It's not that this guy found an alien spaceship submerged. Who knows what he found? But what is real is that Cooper was spying on the hot zone for NASA. That's very important information for what we're looking for. Two, that he kept that information with his memory and the coordinates of it, and he found a number of anomalies in that area. Three, the fact that they're exploiting it as Spanish galleon stuff and trying
That's
to get
a great cover story.
Yeah, oh, it is. But it seems like something very unusual happened with this guy coming out and, I guess, trying to pitch a third season of his show, and suddenly he finds an alien spaceship down there. The show's called Cooper's Treasures, by the way. It's on the Discovery Network. And there's no problem with the show. It's just I'm trying to get us to the core of the story of Cooper, and the hype is kind of in the way. So what I can say is this, that after August, they went completely silent on this anomaly, and that tells me that maybe they were running into issues about it. I'm going to keep rolling. United States astronaut Gordon Cooper. Okay. Project Gemini. So I'm going to keep going on. Miklos, the treasure hunter, said, I want to investigate it. I want to see what it is, because it may be nature made or just a freak of nature. But given its placement in this particular part of the Caribbean, and given what Gordon has told me about visitors from another planet, remember Gordon Cooper wrote a letter to the UN along with the president of Grenada, which, by the way, a couple of years later we invaded, that they wanted to develop an understanding within the, you know, halls of the UN about this ET presence. So he certainly was on the ball with this. Given what Gordon has told me about visitors from another planet and the things that I've seen, I think it's definitely worthwhile investigating. And then they ask the Discovery Channel and all this stuff. There's the hype part. However, they say, in the show, we didn't enter too far into Cooper's UFO interests and what he had told Daryl about what he had seen. I don't feel like we've even scratched the surface of what's in Cooper's files. Okay, so blah, blah, and they continue. However, we want to find out exactly what it is and establish whether it ties in with Cooper's belief that we're not alone. I'll tell you what's interesting about this. Cooper definitely kept these anomalies in mind, and he definitely was seeing them in the hot zone. It's very unusual for somebody with this ET belief, one, two, understanding what's going on in the hot zone. They probably clued him in, and they probably said to him, look, you know, you can keep your mouth shut about the UFO issue, keep your mouth shut about this, which is what you see down there in terms of the anomalies and this incredible sprawling metropolis of an underwater city that went underground. This is where I think this goes. Now, that kind of, and keep Cooper in mind, he was a good true blue American, and he was doing what he was told, but in the back of his mind, he may just have kept those coordinates, and he may very well have had maps relating to them. I don't really think that much of it had anything to do with Spanish galleons, but that's just me. Okay, let's keep rolling here. There's a picture of that anomaly, by the way, that they found. It doesn't reveal a whole heck of a lot, but I have a closer shot of it. In essence, it looks kind of like a grounded something on the ocean bottom there. And it has some kind of man-made type features. I would say that that is certainly true. It's interesting because, of course, we have the Bimini Road, which is actually kind of better, in a sense, for demonstrating that exact thing. There's a couple of things about the Bimini Road, which is it's right there off the coast of Bimini. You know, this is in under 300 feet of water, and it's visible. You know, if you're flying over, you can see it. Now, it wasn't visible pre-1968, but interestingly enough, who predicted that in 1968 we would begin to find the sunken temples of Poseidon, that part of Atlantis off of Bimini? It was the sleeping prophet Edgar Cayce. So Cayce gave us the knowledge and said this was part of land rising off the east coast of America, and that the land was associated with Atlantis, and that actually their construction was going to rise with it. So the temple that went down by Bimini, which was a temple of Poseidon. So this is all very fascinating when we start to piece it together. And then we have the work of Egerton Sykes, which we're going to touch on just briefly here. Before we do that, since I mentioned Cayce, I wanted to just give a brief overview of what he says is there and what culture that it related to. This is directly from the readings. The reading, if you want to search it out, is 440-5 in the Cayce archives.
I love that you know this by heart.
Oh, well, this is a classic one. You know, it's burned into my memory. As is the 262 series.
What is 262?
That is the, most of those readings relate to the Search for God groups, but mm-hmm. they are loaded with the most incredible psychic information. That is developing your own abilities and so on.
I see.
Quite remarkable. Mm-hmm. It's great. When you get to the Search for God information in the Cayce readings, you don't get like expand your third eye and all the rest of it. The first lesson in there is cooperation. So, of course, you know, we need that more than anything.
We resist that terribly.
No question about it. I'll remind everyone, you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. It's great to have so many people here. And boy, we're coming up to episode 50 of the X series. We're on 47 here. And we're going to be, just a programming note, we're going to be doing a two-parter on, I guess it's March 8th and 9th. You can double check that for me on the calendar, but it's Friday and Saturday. And that'll be episode 49 and episode 50. And those are going to be quite remarkable. Of course, we're coming back next week as well. Okay, back to the Casey reading. This is Casey telling us about what's going on there in Bimini and what the Atlantis Firestones are about. Pay close attention to... Remember, it's this reading where he gives us the date saying Temple of Poseidon will rise, the first portions of it in 68 and 69, and then they find the Bimini Wall. Not to suggest that Casey's just some great predictor, but he's trying to tell us about a condition, something that is happening. You know, when they found the King Tut's tomb in 1922, it caused a sensation. It raised our whole consciousness and awareness about Egypt because it was the first tomb found intact. In fact, all the other tombs had been ransacked and all the rest of it. And this really gave us the feeling and the flavor of what Egypt was about. When we find these structures in relation to Atlantis under the water and they become part of the historical record, our complete perspective is going to change about everything relating to prehistory. And so this story about Noah and all the rest of it is going to take on a different tone, and also the scientific idea that, like, well, you know, we had these very primitive people, hunter-gatherers around, and then boom, the Egyptians showed up. That's also going to have to be thrown out. And one of the guys who I think really helps us throw it out is Casey. Okay, quote, speaking about the Two-Eye Stone in questions, which was the large power station crystal that ran Atlantis, and by the way, could make planes fly, rockets go, cars move, submarines go, heat, energy. This is a pure breakthrough energy source. About the Firestone that was in the experience, did the activities of the entity then make those applications that dealt with both constructive and destructive forces in the period? It would be well that there be given something of a description of this, that it may be better understood by the entity in the present. That it may, as to how both constructive and destructive forces were generated by the activity of this stone. Now, I want to say two things about the Two-Eye Stone, which is, the spelling is T-U-A-O-I. There are very unusual things in relation to this name, like we've tracked the Tua de Dun and this unusual group that came through Ireland and mythology, but had very unusual abilities, mythical abilities, and yet they're actually on the record. So he actually talks about the building and so on, but I'll spare us this. He says the building was about the stone was oval or a dome wherein there could be the rolling back so that the activity of the stone was received from the sun's rays or from the stars, the concentrating of the energies that emanate from the rays to the stars, the concentrating of the energies that emanate from bodies that are on fire themselves. So they're not just getting solar power, they're actually getting star power through these crystals. They're on fire. The concentration through the prisms of glass, as would be called in the present, was in such a manner that it acted upon the instruments that were connected with the various modes of travel. So it's generating energy for these craft to fly around. Quote, the preparation of this stone was in the hands only of initiates at the time, and the entity was among those that directed the influences of the radiation that arose in the form of rays that were invisible to the eye, but that acted upon the stones themselves as set in the motivating forces either for aircraft that were lifted by gases in the period or guiding more pleasure vehicles that might pass along close to the earth, or what might be termed crafts on the water, under the water. These were impelled by the concentrating of rays from the stone that were centered in the middle of the power station or powerhouse that would be termed in the present the Two-Eye Stone. So the Two-Eye Stone is the ultimate power center in Atlantis, and it's centered in Poseidon, which is the portion around Bimini. So much of the activity that we've observed in relation to what we call archaeological wars, like the looting of the Baghdad Museum, relates to them looking for ancient modes and ancient understanding around advanced technology, and also what kind of advantages could be gained from this and understanding this. So we know that the programs exist, and we know that they're active out there. This particular program in the hot zone, I believe, has been kept under wraps very well because of the nature of the hotbed of political activity. You could always say, that's too hot to handle, let's classify that, when people just wouldn't talk about it. Or you left with spooky stories about the Bermuda Triangle and UFOs, which, by the way, all tend to pan out. So how spooky are they? Those are the most spooky ones. So basically, what we need is a grounded understanding of the Atlantis landmass that was there, one. Two, the types of technology they possessed. Three, the games that these major forces are playing in order to get their hands on this material in the hot zone, and the hot zone being between Bimini on one end and the Yucatan Peninsula on the other, with the western tip of Cuba, where Paulina Zelitsky found entire, not just a couple of ruins, but an entire metropolitan city under there, of pyramids and sphinxes and all the rest of it. And I think her testimony is some of the most powerful in relation to this. So I think that we're getting a picture that this is how we can look at and observe things relating to the hot zone and how important it is from a geopolitical perspective, on one hand, archaeologically, scientifically, and ultimately spiritually, because there's a whole consciousness that comes, like I was saying, with the King Tut discovery. With this, it changes your entire history. And it's in a very sensitive area here, when you think about it, right off the coast of America. But you have things like Cuba and Venezuela, and you have Russians coming in to bolster Venezuela now. And, you know, so over and over again, the tensions, the political tensions around this area, just like you find them in Jerusalem and the Palestinian issue, there's some kind of a hot zone thing about this activity as it relates to ancient cultures and ancient technology. Okay, a quick thing here on Egerton Sykes and his research. One quick thing, since Casey mentioned that there were these Atlantean activities in America. This is definitely a Mayan figurine, but you'll never guess where it was found. It was found in a cave in Arkansas. Now, you might expect to find this possibly in the Yucatan, but in Arkansas? How would that work? Well, it's in a museum there, and there's a whole story about it being found there. Nobody quite understands how it got there, but there are these cultural migrations that happened in America, and America is a crucial place that really archaeologically has not been specked out properly for the types of stories that we're talking about. Yes, Miss Olivia.
Before you went on to Egerton Sykes, yes. We have two questions about Casey.
Oh, yeah.
So Bill Ferry, who is our Edgar Casey yes. friend, said it was reading number 440 what? What was the reading?
The reading is 440-5.
Okay.
Yes.
And somebody else was asking, where can they find the Edgar Casey records online that they can research? There's some sort of research.
Well, there's edgarcasey.org. Everything is at the ARE, so the Association of Research and Enlightenment. But if you go to the edgarcasey.org or ARE.com, they have all of the records there. As a matter of fact, if you become a member, you can get the entire records collection that's searchable. So you can search by topic or whatever. But some of the best books to start with, definitely, even though it's from 1968, it's still incredibly advanced. It's the book by Edgar Evans Casey, who was Casey's son, called Edgar Casey and Atlantis, that gives the real foundational information about Atlantis and the readings in relation to the advanced technology. In my opinion, I think it's tough what the ARE has to do to... They have a lot of things that they need to run, and it's not easy, I think, having all this powerful information and how do you present it. The only place that I think that they haven't done a good job is in relation to Atlantis, where I think they kind of dropped the ball. Atlantis is an incredibly powerful story, and Casey's readings on it are the most cutting edge, the most complete presentation of information about Atlantis that you'll find anywhere, even in theosophy or anthroposophy. There's nobody who went deeper into the subject and gave us, there's over 900 readings dealing with Atlantis. I mean, it was a major focal point of the Casey readings. And yes, he did readings of predictions, and yes, he did readings about health. But his real, one of the most dominant areas was Atlantis and its relation to this period in time, and how the Atlanteans were basically reincarnating again to face themselves, and so it's us facing us from the past, to walk through these circumstances of having these advanced technologies without destroying, you know, going through this incredible inundation and period of destruction again. So it's kind of major, and I feel like it's also incredibly sci-fi in a way. I mean, the things that he's talking about, craft that fly through mountains, you know, groups that can levitate blocks with their minds. I mean, this is very cutting edge. And the power station itself, there's a lot of evidence for the crystal in mythology, because remember, history becomes legend at a certain point. Yes.
Najat Madri has an interesting question. She says, has the government tried to get a hold of the Casey readings? Of course, the readings are completely open to everyone, but that would be a great topic for a show, is Casey and...
I'll tell you a weird thing. Mm-hmm. There are 29 Casey readings that have disappeared. One of the most important ones is the follow-up readings that he was giving to a group that were studying the Bimini area and looking for gold, because of the idea, they actually wanted to develop it as a tourist attraction. And then they had the idea in relation to kind of treasure hunting. And they did this incredible readings that Casey did on it. And he kept going into this Atlantean part. But when they came back for a follow-up, the reading had disappeared when they did the second version. And so the Casey Foundation never had it. I've always felt that that reading was very important and powerful in it. Now, Casey would go at certain times in his life from town to town giving readings, sometimes not with his regular stenographer, but with somebody just kind of doing it on the fly as a temp. And those readings would get lost in history. So there are some readings that we just do not have. Plus, they weren't keeping tight readings, I believe, until about 1918. So you've got almost 30 years of incredible material there, but he'd been giving readings for many years before that. So it's a good question.
Bill Ferry says that during World War II, Casey said that reincarnated Atlanteans were leading every country.
Yes. Yeah. Excellent point.
And probably are today.
Yes.
I mean, how did these people come in with, especially these CEOs of these huge corporations?
What Bill Ferry has made me think of is this very unusual quote where he's talking about Atlantis, and they're asking him about ruling families in Atlantis. And he said one such family is back, basically, and it was the Dodge family, you know, from the Dodge cars. I found that very interesting, that these were kind of roles that they were playing out over and over again. That is really the deeper cosmological end of the spectrum here. And we do, you know, we can touch upon that because it's all interrelated. What I'm trying to, I guess, steer us toward in this episode is that when you look at the hot zone accounts and about mapping the ocean floor and how there are certain contractors who, if they see something, they can't say anything, that becomes an actual, you know, like an NDA, that you can't speak about it, tells us that there's a well-known established track record of people running into these things, and they had to develop a process in order for that information not to get out because they're studying it. Even the work that Gordon Cooper was doing from space studying magnetic anomalies, I believe, is related to them trying to discover what is it that's going on with the hot zone. First of all, why is there such incredible UFO activity down there? What is the Bermuda Triangle? What is all that disappearances or the magnetic anomalies that go on there? Now, we did a show to start the year off on Thomas Townsend Brown. One of the interesting things was about that episode was that came up was that, you know, his family determined that when he was taking these trips to San Antonio and how he's being so close with physicist Robert Sarbacher, who, remember, gave us that lineage of the UFO file, that he was actually going to San Antonio, Cuba, which is what? The western tip of Cuba again. Now, this is a guy who studied electrogravitics. This is somebody who studied the entire, you know, he's known from the Brown-Byfield effect, Byfield-Brown. This is all about magnetic currents and the development of anti-gravity machines. Why is he spending so much time on the tip, western tip of Cuba? This gives us the clue to what they're studying there and why it's so important. But it also may be the very reason why Poseidia had that temple there at Bimini, and why this becomes then the crucial kind of bullseye that all these people are zoning into. It's somewhere in that hot zone. I think that these things do come together, and I think that the setup, if you've been watching the X series, that we've given through the Hemingway material and the combination of the Kennedy-Hemingway groups moving that information out of Cuba that Hemingway was studying, and the fact that Hemingway got a reading with Edgar Cayce, his mother got a reading with Edgar Cayce about him, and that the mother was close with Hugh Lynn Cayce, who was Cayce's son. I mean, there's an awful lot of material here, and as we go through each episode, we have to kind of complement the things that we've done along with explaining the new info. Let's get into Egerton Sykes, and then we'll take your questions. How does that sound?
Sure. Will you go into his background? I forget exactly who he was and why he knew so much.
Egerton Sykes, it's a very interesting character because he was part of British intelligence, and he knew everyone, put it to you that way. A lot of the things that he said were on record, and, you know, he's known for doing this, bringing forward the book that came out of the 1860s, which was Atlantis, the Antediluvian World by Ignatius Donnelly, who's somebody who eventually became a vice presidential candidate, very unusual figure himself. But Donnelly's book was such an incredible, you know, it's part of this explosion of Atlantis information that we get in the 19th century. Ignatius Donnelly, when the book was put out again in 1952, it had been redone by Sykes. And this is somebody who, when he wrote the foreword to it, it made the book popular again. People knew, oh, okay. And he threw out the stuff that didn't make sense and just kept it a very nice, tight volume. So, this is somebody who was incredibly methodical and somebody who had been through two world wars and seen revolutions and all the rest of it. As a British intelligence agent, he came across the fact that Russia had spent a lot of time looking in the hot zone. And he came to the conclusion that Russia and China and America and Cuba were all looking for Atlantis under the waves there. And that it was very easy to get into the dispersion of Atlantis to America, to Egypt, to Spain, and that he felt that groups like the historians were being incredibly naive and that they just didn't want to look at the evidence that was there, suggesting this incredibly dominant culture that was advanced had been there. And he found the best information for it in the Druid Celtic accounts. Now, one of those we're going to touch on real quickly. Let's see if I can get Sykes here. You can jump to another question there, Miss Olivia.
I've never heard of this. Aniela wants to know if you've ever heard about the Polarians.
Polarians.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they must come up somewhere.
If you have any information, please contact us.
Send it over to info@darkjournalist.com. I'd love to see it. This is Egerton Sykes, the end of his life there with his massive library, which he donated to the ARE, and unfortunately they have not digitized it. There is a group out there of some people who were close to Egerton Sykes who have his information, but I've been studying his stuff that is, you know, definitely, basically, I think with Sykes, it's very unusual how his information has gone underground a number of times. And this is somebody who authored many books, who edited many books. He edited the Atlantis Journal from 1952 to 1983. And he got the top scholars, the best scientists, the best researchers, the best anthropologists to contribute to that magazine. And we still have that magazine, you know, parts of the information that they brought forward flowing around out there. And this is somebody who, again, is kept as the real hardcore. He's kept the real hardcore information, but he's not much of a grandstander, so we don't know much about him. But he certainly had that allegiance with the Casey Foundation at the end of his life. Oddly enough, what he said about the Casey Foundation is that they had all the great information from Casey, but he felt that they lacked a kind of boldness in pursuing Casey's information. And it's not so much a criticism. I think it was a constructive criticism. Okay. Sykes believed that in Celtic legend, when we get to the Tuatha De Danann, that we are talking, one of the cities that they come from is called Murias. He believes that Murias was Bimini. Now, there's a book called Ireland's Mysterious Legends and Sunken Cities, Legends and Folklore. It's John Douglas Singer. It's a very informative little book. I highly recommend it. So the question is, why did Sykes think that Murias was Bimini? Sykes thought that the Irish legends of the sacred cauldron of the Dagda, which come from Murias, and American Indian as well as conquistador tales about the Fountain of Youth at Bimini were derived from the same sources. This is very interesting. Sykes did not mention Arthur Brown's The Origin of the Grail legend, but that book described an Irish epic, Cath Mhaoin Tuired, which may date to the 9th century AD. In the poem, the Tuatha De Danann had a magic well which brought the dead back to life and healed the mortally wounded. Druid physicians attended the well and chanted healing spells. This well was located in the land of four cities. Egerton Sykes suggested, that the ancient civilization might have extended from the Miami, Florida area. In the Bermuda Mystery, which is the book that he wrote in 1964, he says that Commander Soborowski, a marine geologist, studied the Grand Bahama area and concluded that the Bimini and Andros area had been connected to the mainland of America and that the Bahama banks had been dry land up until relatively recent times. This is a crucial piece because apparently what happens is Atlantis goes down, and the last sort of dominant part of it is Poseidia. But then most of Poseidia goes down and there's something left. And what's left is this area between Florida, Bimini. It's the hot zone area, exactly, which is why all the ruins are along. But then there's one other shift that gets rid of them too. But most of these legends that we hear about from the Tuatha De Danann and what we're hearing about in relation to the Bimini Wall and Poseidia is that there was an incredible healing crystal temple there that was basically world famous for all of these different groups coming. And there's a lot of Celtic legends of people journeying there to get revived. Now, oddly enough, it was Les Hemingway who found the rejuvenation waters well in Bimini, where people would go and experience these incredible things like, you know, they'd go in there once and their arthritis was gone and all these strange healings would occur. So this is all related in what he has found. Also, Sykes, he always had sources to point to. However, he said one thing that's very, very interesting that I want to put on the record here, and then we'll go to questions. Sykes claimed that in the hot zone, there is a temple of Isis that's clearly Egyptian. And he is somebody who studied it for a number of years. He's somebody who was from British intelligence, but he would never give his source for saying there was an Isis Egyptian temple there in the hot zone, close to Bimini. It's very, very unusual. And I think that the Sykes aspect of this is something that we really need to get to the full picture of what's happening there at the hot zone. We are looking at something where we need the expert opinion. We need, kind of to use the new technology to look at the area. However, with Sykes, we have somebody who did over 40 years of research there. That'll give us some indication of what to look for, basically. So that's why I think Sykes is very overlooked when we talk about this, as was Hapgood. But at least Hapgood gets some credit for looking at things you know, like the pole shift. At least people know him from that. But I think this is crucial, and it forms the foundation of work from people as diverse and hardcore as, you know, Graham Hancock and Robert Schock, John Anthony West. They all had this understanding that the work of Hapgood was very important. And now I want to bring in Sykes to this picture, because I believe Egerton Sykes and his work on Atlantis is, that's the bold picture that we need to figure out things in relation to the hot zone. The story about Cooper is a major, major explosive clue to what's happening there. So with that, Miss Olivia, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Okay, let's start with questions. The most basic question.
Yes.
Roosevelt Media News says, maybe stupid question, but what made Atlantis sink?
No, that's a great question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the mystery schools and the Casey readings seem to agree that it was a massive inundation that was caused by using the two-eye stone in a manner where it was tuned too high. So it's kind of the equivalent of a gigantic nuclear accident now. Now, the people who had possession of the two-eye stone were the Sons of Belial group, which were different from the Sons of Amelius group. Sons of Amelius group used the stone to rejuvenate themselves, and they had a female priestess lineage that communicated directly to beings of the outer spheres. This is the way that the Casey readings give us this history of what they were doing with it. The Belial groups were using it to dominate other lands and also to round up groups and things like that. They're very much, they're described as really kind of base and using the two-eye stone. The better that they got at it, the more dominant a culture they became. We can relate to that a lot with the groups that we see now, the deep state and things like that in the current period. But what's interesting is a lot of people like Graham Hancock and others who study this, they feel that a comet, and Sykes also felt this was true, that a comet came in at 10,000, around 10,500 BC, and just wiped out this whole area, and that there are marks of that comet on the ocean floor. It's quite possible that was just the final blow. But in the mystery school readings, it is, in the Casey readings, in the mystery school lore, it is the action of the two-eye stone in reverse, basically. It's causing that stone to reverberate on itself and set off volcanic activity and inundate the entire area. Originally, when that happened, the first destruction happened, it split the island into three. And then after that, the various islands sank, and then by the end of it, the final island, Poseidia, sank. But Poseidia was the last sort of vestige of the Amelius group, and the Amelius group were the, you know, he calls them the children of the Law of One. They're a more spiritually oriented group, incredibly advanced initiates who were in charge of the crystals. Okay.
Okay, Cold Aussie. Whatever happened about the crystal pyramid they found off Bimini, according to Snopes, cough, it was a fake. But there has always been something interesting about it.
That's not interesting. Well, there have been reports about this. I think what happens is, look, it's a very tricky area in the first place to do any kind of research, because you have to get all kinds of permits. It costs all kinds of money. It's funny that they have this show about the Spanish galleons and stuff. And, you know, for me, the way that I look at it, you know, with television money, you can kind of make it look like it's just easy to roll around down there and get the stuff done. But it's incredibly difficult for any regular expedition. I think there is, because of the Casey readings, a very direct route from Bimini through the Gulf Stream to track the Poseidon temple ruins that he spoke of. That's supposed to be the third hall of records, by the way, the other two being in Yucatan and in Egypt. Those records are supposed to be the Rosetta Stone, in a sense, for us to discover and decipher the Atlantean history. They will give us the understanding of that older culture. Now, what's fascinating is that there seems to be some realization, I would say, this is my own guess, inside the scientific community, that because of the types of technology that we possess, because of the satellite technology, because of the side scan technology, this stuff is going to eventually be found. So my feeling is that they're going to spin it as just some, you know, some culture that went down that was like the Mayans, basically. And if they want to leave it at that, that's something. That's a pretty big step anyway. But I think the real story of Atlantis is a lot bigger. Okay.
Okay, Jeff Thomason, do the Belial correspond to the Ahrimanic spirit?
Yes, actually, they're the same. They're one and the same. Ahriman is very good for us to understand the term now, but it comes out of Persian mythology, and it was specific to the anthroposophical viewpoint because Steiner's very close in with the Western mystery school tradition. And I had not seen Ahriman used as the name for these forces before. I mean, it comes out of Persian mythology, and he is the twin brother, this chimerical twin brother of Ahura Mazda, who's the hero, the kind of Christ figure in Persian mythology. But the Ahrimanic force, the way that Steiner describes it, in a very advanced fashion, by the way, the Ahrimanic force is particularly embedded in technology. And we've done shows on Ahriman and the Eighth Sphere and Steiner's view on that. But the Belial force and the Ahrimanic force are exactly the same thing. It's just that the Belial, the term, is more of the biblical aftermath, and that's the language that Casey decided to use.
Okay. Braden Lockwood, did Atlantis' sinking open the door for negative entities to enter the Earth among us?
Well, that's all, you know, that's certainly very interesting. I happen to feel that it must have been so incredibly devastating to have this culture there that was dominating everything and, you know, were thought of as kind of like the New York City of today and or the Los Angeles of today, and just to have that gone. It must have been just incredible. But what's talked about in the mystery schools, which I find interesting, is that it doesn't seem like it's just a deluge. That is, it's not just a flood, and how horrible is that enough? But there's something that they were using there, and I think that this is where the two-eye stone comes in, that there's some effect that had to be locked up, that it was so disruptive to the evolutionary path of humanity on Earth that the Atlanteans had unleashed, that I think that gets... That gets me more as to where I'm thinking about it in terms of the evil that was unleashed in that period of time. But remember, even in Plato's account, it's when men could be gods. So there was some quality, there was something they had figured out in that period where they just had too much access to power. And in this case, psychic and physical power. So yeah, it's a pretty powerful one. Okay.
Well, that leads me right into the next question. Yes. From Mr. Eggshin. Why are they keeping this information secret? Well, if it makes a man a god or godlike.
Well, governments and groups keep secrets for power. So the reason you have the wall of secrecy around the UFO file is because they don't want the general public to understand the advantage that lies within it. Now, it's true, they may not want other countries to understand it either. That's sort of the fundamental go-to position. But after 60 years, you can imagine those other countries already know. So now a number of countries know. I would say America most in the know. And I'd put Russia a close second, and I'd put China a third. But, you know, that wall of secrecy is held by groups like X-Protect, and we've described these groups, X-Protect and X-Share. You have to keep it in mind. There's a group inside the system, scientists, political figures, etc., who I refer to as X-Share, who want to get that kind of technology out to the public, who want to get that kind of knowledge out to the public. The X-Protect group exercises lethal force to keep the secrets, not as a first option, but, I mean, ultimately they would. So therefore, I think what we're talking about is the split of opinion about how to handle this information. One, about our ancient past. Two, about the advanced technology. Three, about the off-world visitors. Four, about who we really are. It's a lot of information to keep hidden. But it's much easier to keep you a reality TV dope, you know, if they don't tell you that, for example. And in the alternative media, you know, they can have you running around in circles chasing galactic ambassadors or all kinds of junk. So that's another way to just keep you off. Hey, I'll just pump a little bit of that in there and you're done. So they certainly have their reasons, not only for keeping you out of the loop, but for keeping you in a false loop. And they've done a pretty good job. But not anymore, right, Olivia?
No, because something is shifting for all of us, and we all feel it. There's, I mean, this is what the apocalypse is, really. It's a consciousness that's opening up. It's the age of Aquarius. I mean,
we apocalypse. Have I like this.
It's the veils yeah. being lifted. We all know it, you know, and we are, the apotheum is upon us. It is happening.
Say it three times fast.
Exactly. Okay.
Great questions tonight. We'll take a couple more questions. We're doing really well on time, but we'll take a couple more and then we'll move it.
Okay. Brent Burnside. Yes. Was this stone powerful enough to shift the entire planetary axis to its current position at 23.5 degrees?
Yes. Well, what's interesting is I'm going to go to Casey on this because he is supported by a number of different sources when you look at it scientifically, including Einstein. Casey says that in 50,722 BC, the Atlanteans had a major meeting about how to get rid of basically the dinosaurs. Now, it's very unusual because the dinosaurs in traditional anthropology, in traditional history, are understood to have been eliminated in 65 million BC by comets and all the rest of it. 65 million BC, and here we have 50,722 BC, and Casey's saying, well, they're figuring out in Atlantis with a death ray how to get rid of the dinosaurs. The wild beasts that were overrunning the Earth at that point. Okay, so they were going to, from the center, send out these death rays, these lasers, to get rid of. So they're going to use the two-eye stone to do this. And what happens, he says, is that the pole-shifting ice does it for them, basically. So there's a pole shift that takes place there in 50,000 BC, according to him. That's pretty remarkable. We have to also remember this. America, for example, has been around 200 some odd years. Really, if you think about it, the way that he describes Atlantis, they're around from 200,000 BC to 10,500 BC. So when we say Atlantis, we're talking about a lot of different stages there. So I guess the stage that we're referring to is the 50,000 stage when we talk about the pole shift. And then the next stage of destruction is 22,000 BC. And then the final stage of destruction for Atlantis is 10,500 BC. And then comes the construction of the Great Pyramid, 10,490 BC to 10,390 BC. This is the movement. This is the lineage of it. I would say that the hot zone area in the landmass that was the vestiges of Poseidia existed after this deluge. And that there's another shakeout, which is recorded in the Casey readings, that takes Iltar's temple down. That's when that group goes. That's the final dose of that group. And they're remembered in these legends. Now, what's funny is Bimini's still there. And so there's this idea that the Tuatha De Danann went from Bimini to Ireland. And that this is the city Mirius that's recorded in Ireland legend in relation to this group. And I have to tell you, the group itself, as we've done, we did a show on the Tuatha De Danann, and I mean, they really do fit this profile of advanced Atlanteans coming into this kind of primitive territory of the Irish. And, you know, I think a lot of the magic in those myths comes from the fact that this is a pretty exceptional group. I do want to point out that this was these are the graphics from the Paulina Zelitsky. These are the actual scans. Let's start this, just a couple of quick ones here. Those are the actual side scans. I mean, this is a metropolis down there.
Actually, while you're on that, yes. Johann Wolf wanted to know where they can find the complete high-res Zelitsky images online.
Well, it's interesting. I would say that there's going to be something in relation to Zelitsky's work coming up, which is going to be a complete thing. Right now, you're going to find stories from AP. You're going to find documentaries that picked up on her work. but certainly Zelitsky's books contain her personal story, which I think is very interesting about how she got into Cuba in the first place. But in terms of a comprehensive source, it's literally you're sorting through articles for what's been submitted there. And like I said, coming up, you're going to find there is going to be more in relationship. I do want to say this about Zelitsky, who came forward. You know, look, this is a historic find that she made there. It's a city off the western tip of Cuba, whatever you want to call the city. She discovered it. It was widely broadcast through all the media. Everyone knows that's what she found. The Cuban government hired her to find shipwrecks. Here we go. And I always feel that, you know, whenever a government is using that, or just like they used it with Cooper, what are we actually talking about? Is it shipwrecks that they're talking about? Or is it, do they know that the hot zone contains these ruins and that they're hiring these people? And this is their public reason for hiring them, because they can't say, hey, go down there and find Cuban ruins of Atlantis off the tip. But I want to say that in relation to Zelitsky's work, what she did was explosive. I mean, you know, this is the biggest find of the past, I mean, maybe ever. So how did the story get obscured? And I've gone into the history and the very unusual circumstances that took place after she found it, including the fact that, you know, they placed her in a Mexican prison at one point. And she suffered a lot of harassment at the hands of different interests. So, you know, I do feel that her story is going to be coming forward in a new way. So definitely watch for that. Okay, let's take a couple more.
Okay, Lee Johnson says, why don't you ask the Farsight Institute to remote view the hot zone? They do things like this all the time. And Adam Garcia says, somebody needs to pay to have the Bimini area analyzed by geoscan satellite technology. They did it for Giza. Why not here?
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. You can be sure that somebody is doing that.
Yeah, that's true.
I would say this in relation to the other question. It's tricky with remote viewing. There are some very exceptional remote viewers, and I know some of them. But I don't think that the Farsight Institute would be the first place I would go for this. But I think you've got the right idea that using remote viewing and the kind of a psychic archaeology in relation to this is a fantastic approach. Okay, Miss Olivia.
Okay, David Tormina. DJ, if the X technology is the legacy of the Two-Eye Stone, then isn't the 5/6G rollout a repeat of history, and Trump is selling it now? We were having this conversation earlier today.
Well, look, I will say this. In relation to 5G, obviously, whether we want to or not, we all have to pay attention to it, report on it, and make sure community by community that it doesn't happen. It's a big, big, big problem. And I think that what came out as a statement by Trump about 5G was just that kind of pro-business approach. And I think that it's way off to support 5G. Look, the protocol that they're using to say 5G is safe is from 1998 when they didn't have it. So there's a whole list of sound scientists and medical professionals that are saying it's unsafe. So I know they want to, you know, basically they've got these 20,000 new satellites in space and they want this super fast, super controlled environment. But if they're going to fry everyone in the process, then it's going to be like, you know, a slow motion nuclear accident, mm-hmm. you know? So there are times when you just have to stop these things that happen. And the way that you do it is by public demand. And that's what it's going to get to the more that we find out about 5G, of course. So yeah, I think the president's statement on that was misguided. Yes.
Okay. Once we get on the Two-Eye Stone, nobody wants to let go of it. Okay. Grandma Tippy Toe says, please ask DJ if the Two-Eye Stone is from Earth or was it from another planet?
You know, I've done some interesting things about this. The way that Casey talks about it, it seems that the Atlanteans were able to create it because they were in a an entirely different mental body, an entirely different frame of mind. They had access to information that came from the spiritual realm. So there is this otherworldly quality to the stone, but there's no question the way that he described it, it is an actual physical crystal stone. So much like things like the crystal skull, for example, that we got, there's something about crystal. As anyone can tell you, crystal runs most of what we have going on today in terms of advanced technology. So I would say that it's obviously its properties took on an otherworldly quality, because one of the things that Casey stresses over and over again in those readings, and that we have to really hear and understand, is that the priestesses who used the two-eye stones were prepared in such a way that they could interface with beings from the outer spheres, spiritual beings. So there's a cosmology there for sure. But the idea is these initiates would craft these women to be purified to the point where they could interact with this crystal and get this kind of information and direction directly from the spiritual realm through the conduit of the two-eye stone. To take that process and make it into just a physical process, and eventually, you know, just like we have nuclear power that can serve electrical needs, yes, but we can also use nuclear power to bomb somebody. The problem happens when it goes out of the hands of the initiates, or the people in this case who have good intentions. It gets into the hands of the Belial groups. They use it. Not only do they use it to dominate other groups, but they also use it in such a foolish way that they blow themselves up, in a sense, essentially that. So it is, I would say there's no question about the two-eye stone that it takes on an otherworldly quality, but it's nonetheless a physical property here from Earth, I would say. And I do think that in speaking with Gigi Young about it and some of the work that she's done around it, she has a very, very interesting perspective about it, which I think she's going to talk more about it as we get into some more shows. Okay.
Okay, the Cosmic Garden. So where is the stone now? Inside a dimensional bubble ready to pop? And also, if someone were to bilocate to view the hot zone, would this be safe for consciousness considering the apotheum effects? That's an intriguing question.
Reminds me of Bingo Swan, who, when they send him into these dangerous situations, sometimes a telepath would turn on him, who could see him coming in and remote viewing something. They had Ingo Swan remote viewing the moon, which I find quite extraordinary. I think that you would have to be, if you were somebody doing that kind of work, you'd have to be aware of the environment. And, you know, I would imagine when you're a good psychic or remote viewer, certain bells and whistles go off when you're in any kind of danger. But certainly I do think that there are secrets that are protected there in the hot zone. I'll tell you a weird story, another Casey story, where this woman said, was talking about if she could launch an expedition to Egypt, basically, to open the Hall of Records, because she was dedicated to this idea. And one of the things that Casey said was, well, you might not be able to pull that off, but you probably can enter into the Hall of Records. That is, he was saying with her consciousness, she could actually be there. So there is this aspect with the Atlantean information and the technology. It takes on not only a physical reality, but it seems to exist in an ethereal reality. That gets pretty deep, but I think it's worth thinking about in that sense. Somebody who was, quote, psychic enough, intuitive enough, they would have the ability to do that. Absolutely. Yes.
I don't know if this is going to work, but Rhonda Richardson says that you started talking about timing, what timing had to do with the safety factor within the triangle, but you never finished your comment. Can you recall that?
Yeah, I do feel that it's important to think about this. There are people who go through, and there are planes that fly through the Bermuda Triangle. A lot of them do avoid it, but there are people who, there's shipping lanes and you can't avoid it ultimately. So in a number of cases, things are just hunky-dory. There's no problem. But there are these cases. There's so many cases in this area. That's where it developed that reputation. So obviously it has something to do with the period and the timing and the conditions that set up this vortex apotheum activity that takes place. I think it is worthwhile to try to track certain types of astrological, astronomical conditions when these things occur. Certainly, the timing is important. Absolutely. I agree 100%. I want to remind everyone you're watching the Dark Journalist Show. It's a fantastic crowd tonight. Great questions. We're going deep into the hot zone, Bimini, Cuba, NASA mystery. We found out earlier that Gordon Cooper was hired to spy on the hot zone from space. We've gone deep into Egerton Sykes' work and even Columbus's voyage and the strange effects when he got into this zone, the things that are happening there. We've examined this question. I think that we are just at the precipice, just now getting into what the hot zone is really all about. And this is a pivotal period of time. And I think a lot of researchers are coming forward and realizing this Atlantis factor is very important for us right now. It's the Atlantis rising aspect, which the mystery schools told us about, which the Casey readings told us about. And we know that even people in all these different celebrity circles, like John Lennon had bought lots where he thought Atlantis was going to rise in the Atlantic Ocean. We know that Les Hemingway, Ernest Hemingway's brother had bought a whole section off of Jamaica there and called it New Atlantis, hoping that Atlantis was going to rise. There's something that these people hear about and understand in relation to landmass rising there. And that is what we're getting at in relation to the hot zone. That's why there's so much heavy duty activity from Russia in relation to Venezuela, the Cuban dance with the Americans, the incredible secrecy on the American side about the hot zone. So we need to get more information about it. And I think it is through the lens of people like Paulina Zelitsky, through the lens of people like Egerton Sykes, through the incredible work of people like Casey, that we start to get a feel for what's at stake there, what's so important about that. I'll remind everyone to sign up for the newsletter at darkjournalists.com. This is the best way for us to stay in touch, and you'll get an email about once a week letting you know what shows are coming up. There's some very, very special events that you're going to want to be a part of. You need to be on that newsletter list. Olivia knows. She knows. And I want to remind you to sign up at the site. We've made it very affordable for you to subscribe to the site. Get behind the show and the work that we're doing. It's crucial. It's important for those shows that are giving you level-headed analysis, giving you the information, and doing the research. It's great for us to get the support and for you guys to do that, and we do appreciate it. Okay, Miss Olivia.
Okay, we'll so Jim Roy the Heretic says the Bay of Pigs was about control of the hot zone.
Yes.
He also added, so he met Gordon Cooper.
Oh, nice.
And he said that he had the most intense eyes I've ever seen, like some ET, brilliant man. Yeah. Cooper said to us in the room, quote, ETs are here. Go get the information. It's out there, unquote.
I do feel that Gordon Cooper was a very, very special individual. And I think his space mission career was just one half of what he was up to. He was certainly an extraordinary fellow. I wanted to say one thing that I forgot. I completely forgot the Abiku Secret Society in Cuba. I'm just going to show you a couple of quick images from a very unusual fraternity, secret society in Cuba, and their ex-steganography. They reside in the northwest of Cuba, close to that Cuban tip. And they are such an unusual group. And the group that you compared them to, Olivia, was
the Heyoka.
The Heyoka. So we'll start with the
Pueblo
Heyoka.
Clowns.
These are the Pueblo Clowns. And what are they noted for? Well, they're noted for teaching through
humor.
They're
part of, yes, but they're also part of Akiva, which is a secret society.
Ah, very interesting. Mm-hmm. And they're supposed to teach us through absurdity, the way that I understand it. Trickster, is that?
Yep, you could call them tricksters.
Well, see, that's what you call them. That's, this is a couple of things about these guys before we move on to the final questions. I really want to get these guys on the record. I'm telling you, every time I look at Cuba, it's stranger and stranger. Abacua Society, they're very, very unusual. And they're hermetic, and they're little known even within Cuba. They have some relationship to people who came over from the Congo. But They resemble a Masonic order in so much detail as a fraternity order of secrecy and as a mystery school, in essence, that historians still don't understand the language that they use. But they have this incredible impact on the arts and the culture of Cuba, including things like Cuban music and Cuban dance. Let's take a look at the abacua. You'll notice throughout the outfits, actually, there's all this ex-steganography always. But astronomical symbols, the sun, the moon, the cosmology embedded in the costumes and the rituals gives us some key as to who they are. And I think they are quite fascinating. And we'll do more on them in a solo fashion, but I didn't want to ignore the incredible secret society residing there in Cuba. More of that ex-steganography here, and they're very, very unusual artwork, as you can see. This whole skull and bones approach that they have going on is also, I think, quite interesting. More of these outfits, and I'll tell you, the episode that we're going to do in relation to them is going to be in relation to something called the Golden Circle, which was a very unusual group that tried to, from America, take over Cuba in the 19th century. Very, very unusual indeed. But it relates to all of this.
So let me just ask you, yes. Matt Murtaugh said, do Cuban or Bahamian cultures have any beliefs about Atlantis?
Yes, absolutely. Before I answer that, I'm going to show this picture, which is, again, these very, very unusual ex-rituals that take place with these groups and how they are so closely associated with the Mason culture. By the way, there's a thriving Mason culture in Cuba, which is very unusual because communists don't often allow Mason cultures to exist. They're often outlawed. In relation to that question, give me the question again.
I just deleted it.
Oh, no.
The Cuban or Bahamian cultures have any beliefs
yes.
about...
Yeah, Atlantis? It's interesting. In 1952, and this is something that Egerton Sykes brought forward, and something I was reading in his Atlantis journal, that the Cuban Archaeological Society came to the conclusion that Atlantis was, in fact, Cuba. It was geologically perfect. And what's interesting is Columbus, when he landed in Cuba, thought he was in... Greater North America. He thought this was it. So it's very interesting in terms of that pivotal portion that Cuba is in, but certainly their scholars, their people, there's a pretty big interest in Atlantis in their archaeological ranks. They have, and we've shown these before, the very strange cave systems that are above ground and underground with all the ancient cave paintings, and the ancient cave paintings show all these astronomical things, including something that looks like a comet strike. So certainly strange mystery traditions buried back there in Cuba. And just one last thing I wanted to mention about these guys, the Abacua. Quote, due to the secrecy of the society, little is known of the Abacua language. It's assumed to be a creolized version of Ifik, a related language, dialects from Nigeria, because of the cultural region and the ethnic groups where the society originated. But they actually have no idea where their language came from. They're just kind of like, oh. One of their processes and practices in ritual is called irimi. It's the Cuban term for the masked abacua dancer, known as an idem. The masquerade dancer is carefully covered in a tight-fitting suit and hood and dances with a broom and a staff. The broom serves to cleanse faithful members while the staff chastises enemies and Abacua traitors. During initiation ceremonies, the staff is called Eri Bandu, while during mournings and wakes, it is called Alan Mango and Basua. What's so interesting for this about me is that the group from America, who were the Golden Circle, who wanted to have Havana as their capital, and this very unusual idea of creating a slave region there. But they were dressed in all that kind of Knights Templar regalia in the 19th century. Very unusual group that was incredibly well-funded, and everyone kept trying to figure out where the funding was coming from. That group became the KKK. And if you look at some of the trappings of the Akabua, it's like a strange perversion of the rituals, because they wear hoods over their heads too. So we're gonna bring them forward, including the fact that a member of the Golden Circle was John Wilkes Booth. So we have some very, very strange things there in the background in relation to Cuba. And the Abacua Secret Society is certainly one of them. Okay, Miss Olivia.
I think you answered this in an earlier episode, but Scruples 4444 wanted to know, did I already ask this about Grenada?
Go ahead.
Why did the U.S. really invade Grenada?
Well, it's a mystery. Ostensibly, it was because they didn't want a new Soviet sphere of influence in the area. But it is very unusual because the leader of Grenada in the late 70s had all of this UFO research. He even put UFOs on their stamp, which I find very unusual. And he and Gordon Cooper went to the UN to try to get this ET acknowledgement thing going. And then he's shaken out and somebody else steps in, and then we try to remove the guy who stepped in as a Soviet agent. But it's all very, very unusual, in my opinion. And I don't think anyone really knows. Also, that kind of firepower that they landed, it's pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting. It's a tiny island, and they didn't have any kind of real military. So the official explanation, remember dark journalism, the official explanation, the counter story, and the junk conspiracy, right? All three there. And whenever we look at a story like Granada, we have to do the same thing, try to figure out which level is which. Okay.
How many left? You tell me.
No. I think we do two more questions.
Two more questions?
Yes.
Okay.
Questions are great tonight, my God. And you're doing a fantastic job of grabbing just the right thing.
Well, I'm going to circle back around to this kind of ghost ships and, you know.
Okay.
So Mark Tarana was asking, could this be a similar phenomenon as ghost ships? What about the Philadelphia experiment when you're phasing in and out? And
that, I think, is closer. Mm-hmm. That, I think, is closer. Look, Project Invisibility. That's something that Einstein worked on. One of the things that they tried to say in the Philadelphia Experiment book is that Thomas Townsend Brown worked on that. And remember that Townsend Brown spent a lot of time on the western tip of Cuba. What I think is interesting about that is this idea that something of invisibility could be achieved. Invisibility is part of that apothium effect. And we've talked about how on some of the more controversial advanced flyers that we have now, like the F-35, that it is touted by Trump as having the qualities of invisibility. And this is something that we've certainly been trying to get, and that we have invisibility technology. This is a pretty big, pretty major innovation, but we've been working on it for a long time. Now, when you think about what is achieved in order to do this, what they were actually trying to do with the Philadelphia experiment was have something disappear in one place and show up somewhere else, which is a pretty advanced experiment. But somehow they had some kind of theorem of magnetic formula to think that this was possible. The story that we got of it afterwards is that it was too hazardous to the people involved, and that the ship and the people ended up showing up in the most unusual places when they re-entered the dimension. So there is some very, very advanced information in relation to this. The only thing I can say about it for sure is those people, when they encounter the land anomalies in the Bermuda Triangle or in the hot zone, like the Autech whistleblower, he's seeing a landmass on his radar. Many of those guys have been in there over two decades. They know what a landmass is on their radar. So if a landmass can appear suddenly on their radar and wreak havoc and then disappear, then obviously there's something functioning there, which is far beyond what we know is normal physics. And that, I think, relates to this apothium idea. Absolutely. And it is kind of ghosty. I mean, yeah, I can definitely see where you're coming from. Okay, we'll take one more.
Okay, so I'll just end with the question everybody can find very useful, which is Rhonda Richardson again.
Okay.
Which of all the books currently available regarding Atlantis would you recommend for first read? And then if you could review the books that you already listed early in the show. Well,
I think that there's the work that has been done by people like Graham Hancock around the idea of the lost culture of Atlantis, including Fingerprints of the Gods, is a great foundation book. I like Andrew Collins' book. Is it Gateway to Atlantis? Yes, Gateway to Atlantis. Fundamental books, Edgar Cayce on Atlantis, even though it's from 68. He did another one, which he revised in the late 90s, called The Mysteries of Atlantis Revisited, which is also quite good. I feel like Zink's work, David Zink, is overlooked. The Stones of Atlantis. He was a remarkable person who was very hands-on. And I had something of his to read, which we'll close on for tonight. This is very, very interesting, in my opinion, about the naming of Bimini. And this is somebody who spent a lot of time down there figuring that out. He goes, of course, into all the Ponce de Leon legends. But what he says here, I think, is interesting. Okay, let's see if I can get this. He talks about Egerton Sykes, because Egerton Sykes had a big influence there, even though his work was incredibly dropped off the radar sometime in the 90s. So, Sykes argued that a megalithic culture diffused from west to east, not the reversed, as is usually believed. And then he cites this other book called Bimini by Pierre Carnac. The author draws upon Celtic accounts of early Atlantic voyages and also reasons from what was known as the Bimini site in 1973 and the Mystery Hill site in New Hampshire, which is actually fairly close by. It's like an hour drive from here. Very unusual place. Carnac also, they call it America's Stonehenge now. If you're up there, check it out. Carnac also gives us an interesting linguistic clue as to the possible origin of the word Bimini. This is where I think we should pay attention. Some of the early observers of the culture Columbus found upon his arrival in the Bahamas reported that the natives were very much like the Tainos of Haiti, a tribe closely related to the Arawaks. In 1645, Father Raymond Breton, missionary of the Antilles, prepared a dictionary of the Taino language. Working from it, it translates Bimini as the Island of Ruins or the Island of the Old Wall. Think about what's surrounding wow. Bimini, the Bimini Wall. The Island of the Old Wall, that's what the name means. That's the actual translation. So in another interpretation, he has it as the Island of the Wreath. So the wall is a wreath around. So this is what we've seen.
So it's a round wall.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, what I find fascinating about that is if you put that together with Cayce talking about the Temple of Poseidon and what we have there is the Bimini Wall, and that's the actual name. Then I think we're really getting into some interesting territory.
Spiritus, I don't know who you are. You ask great questions. You're really all over it. Okay, so DJ, could it possibly be that those inhabitants of Atlantis intentionally made a time wormhole? Yes.
Yeah, there's no question about it. As a matter of fact, there's a Steiner reading which talks about how they traversed the universe. Figure that one out. then that gets you into the idea was, you know, if we think about Atlantis and how advanced they were to the point where, you know, they're more advanced than we are, and we went into space. So then did the Atlanteans go into space? Can we talk about a prehistorical space program? That's pretty hardcore. There's no question about it. But we are saying that they had this advanced technology. It follows that they had the ability to travel outside of this sphere. And what's interesting to me is, if we really understand the Atlanteans, you have to remember something again. We're thinking very flesh and blood because of the period that we're in, too. But remember, those early Atlanteans were ethereal, mostly. They were kind of hovering around their physical bodies. So they had abilities to enter into a time and experiences in totally different ways. So they're a very different type of being than what we'd say a modern human being. And so we have to keep that in mind, too. in relation to this? But that is a really excellent question, I have to say. We'll take one more, Miss Olivia.
Cliff High is in the house. I didn't see Cliff when he snuck in. And he says, was prehistory space program secret?
Well, listen, if the Two-Eye Stone, according to Casey and Steiner, was in the hands only of the initiates, then I would imagine it was understood that only the top people handled the stuff. I guess those people had the spiritual training to do it. Apparently, at some point, the Aramonic groups protested this and got their hands on it too. And I think that that's where they start the downfall. But there's no question, if you look at the earlier histories, from the mystery school's perspective, the initiates had the complete run of the technology. One thing I wanted to point out also, a couple of very interesting ex-steganographies that came up. This is an ancient German site, and I found that very interesting. We ran across that one. I love it. This site goes back 13,000 years, and we see them using the X here. And, of course, in relation to the Abakua as well, in their language, they have the X representing speech on one hand, and then the X representing love. This is very interesting to me. that was just some of the X steganography I came up with. Yes, Miss Olivia.
I'm getting a download. So I'm getting distracted. All right. So anyway, I think the real thing is the more we dive into this, we're breaking a trance. We're breaking a spell that we've been under of this idea that we are, morons, for lack of a better word, that we are what they've told us we are, and little better than apes.
Well, you mean that whole, like, the Earth would be so much better off without humans polluting it with plastic bottles?
Yeah, we're very limited creatures, and that something about this makes us dream bigger and open up. I think it's by dreaming bigger, we can become more than what we are now, and
that's very important. The truth is that once we discover as a historical record Atlantis, it changes everything about the way we think of the past. And that whole thing about hunter-gatherers goes right out the window in a cool heartbeat. And what it suggests is a much more advanced purpose behind humanity as well, which I think is absolutely the thing that they're trying to keep down the most. It happens here. It happens. You've got the triangle on one side and you have the hot zone on the other. In that area, we have the Casey readings focusing hard. We have the unusual geopolitical action. We have the Bimini Wall and the rising of Atlantis. We've got these ruins off of Cuba. It's definitely in the hot zone. There's no question about that. And that seems to be a major kind of staging ground for this larger understanding. That's what Casey was giving us and saying, land is rising off the East Coast. And by the way, this is the Temple of Poseidon, which was that portion of Atlantis that went down that had the Two-Eye Stone. So it's pretty remarkable if you tie those things in together. If we can use that kind of psychic information, that kind of psychic archaeology, together with our understanding around the mystery schools, and draw in the scientific aspects to keep it, a grounded picture, basically, and use the archaeological histories, this is what people like Sykes were after. And these were the gifts that we got from people like Blavatsky, giving us that history, when the mystery school let out the secret of Atlantis, basically, there in the 19th century. What were we going to do with it? I'm sure they were curious. What have we done with it? What are we going to do with it? These become the questions. And with that, I think, Miss Olivia, we will wrap it up. But I will say it's been great tonight. Fantastic questions. We'll be back with you next Friday. Remember to go to darkjournalist.com, sign up for the newsletter. And we're looking forward to the spring with some of the incredible shows that we have coming up for you, and also some amazing events that are coming up this spring, summer, and fall. And it's best if you're a member it's going to be the best way to be a part of those events. So go to darkjournalist.com, become a member, and also sign up for the newsletter. Great people out there tonight. Bill Ferry, Jim Roy the Heretic, who has a great presence on Twitter. Of course, there's great conversations taking place on Twitter. We've got O Wings Girl on Twitter, of course. And
Total Addict.
Najat, it's great to have you out there. BB Blog, how fantastic to see everyone. And we will be back with you next week. Of course, Gigi Young, and I've mentioned Gigi's coming back on the show. We're working on something now. And, you know, it's fascinating because right now, I want to say this, we have some of the best people available. They're here today, you know, and some of the greatest researchers are here. And I have to say, as somebody who knew Jim Mars, and, you know, with the passing of Jim Mars and John Anthony West, you realize how important the timing is and the work that we're doing and how important we are here with this information, and these people are here now with us, and we have an incredible opportunity that I can tell you for sure wasn't there, say, 5 or 10 years ago. And also the distractions are at an all-time high as well. So it seems like a very crucial period where we have the correct conditions available in order to move the culture forward and to move ourselves into that understanding. And I can guarantee you that the ex-steganography and the work around the hot zone is a major, major piece of all that information. But when I look out, I'm surrounded by incredible people. And I think that with these incredible people, we can bring these truths forward. And they're here now. So let's get on board now. Let's support them now. And let's get to the bottom of some of these great mysteries. I think that's what we're doing here on this show. And Miss Olivia, with that, you get the last word.
Well, I think I know what we should do for the next Hot Zone episode, because we just were asked a great question about
yes.
it. Professor J. Paul DeVereville, what is the connection of the Hot Zone with Antarctica?
Oh, no question about it. No question about it. I, if you can hang on a second, I can tease you with that next episode. I think I mentioned Buash's work from 1737.
What?
This is his. This is his map, and it's in Map of the Ancient Sea Kings by Charles Hapgood, which I highly recommend. People are always looking for book recommendations. Try that one out. This shows Antarctica on his map. He's got the complete outline of it. Pre-ice. Nobody knows how he got it. I'll tell you another strange thing. Shortly after, he publishes the same map, and it's gone. Now, I'll tell you an interesting thing about him as a map maker is that his family had this incredible background as cartographers, and he was a royal cartographer, royal map maker. This is somebody who knew, and they used him later to map America based on stories that he had read from Native Americans. This is how incredibly clued in this guy was. By the way, I have another shot of his map where he shows a landmass between Africa and South America. So whatever maps he's drawing from, he's obviously got access, again, to those ancient maps like Pere Reis did and like Columbus did. So we're looking at something very important there. So yes, I would say that's where we'll go next time on the Hot Zone. Next week, we'll be back. And I'll give you one last question, guys.
They want to see the book again.
Book you just showed. Charles Hapgood. You know, let me say something about Hapgood. I did an episode on Charles Hapgood, which was the Pole Shift episode. That's Professor Hapgood, one of the greatest scientists I think we've ever had. And he worked very much with the Casey material. And he also worked with Elwood Babbitt, who was kind of like his own discovery of a Casey type psychic. And he did all that, by the way, something like 10 minutes from here. So it's quite interesting history. But the book itself is called Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings. And it goes into such incredible detail about those books, those maps, and the history of that cartography, and how these map makers knew great secrets that we didn't discover until the 20th century. And in great fashion, Hapgood wants to know why, and he pursues it through the book. Quite remarkable, of course, his book, on the Pole Shift is also quite good. So I recommend them both. Wow, Hapkids, just spend some time with that material. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to sneak one last question. Yeah. I'm a cult fan. Ask if Trump has these maps. Ha ha.
This is somebody who could certainly get his hands on them. I would say that. Trump has access, you know, where he is in terms of how he's using that access. It's a good question. But he certainly has the curiosity because of his uncle. And let us not forget Box X at MIT with his uncle's material and his great investigation of Tesla's work after he died, and how the FBI and the Office of Alien Property got him in there and said, you know, analyze that for us. And what did he say that they asked him to do? Well, he said they were particularly looking for something that could take down a flying object at a distance. I mean, think about that. So unidentified flying object became the moniker for these craft just a few years after that. So I tie those things indirectly. And of course, John Trump's mentor was Vannevar Bush, who we know was the head of the UFO file. So there's no question it's a very, very unusual connection. Thank you, everyone. What a fantastic show and great to be here. We will see you next week. And Olivia, the last question of the night is, what's for dinner?
I don't know. Want something spicy. Maybe?
Sriracha?
Sriracha.
Sriracha.
Yeah, something with sriracha on it.
Yum.
I don't think anybody, you know, listen. When it comes to spices, you know what you're talking about.
I like spicy food. Within reason.
I think it sounds reasonable. Mm-hmm. Thank you, everyone. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Great to have everyone out there. Christine Taggart. Wow. Nice to see you. And Cult Fan, that was a great question. Thank you. Fubar Fighter, you're out there. And Esoteric 369, always fantastic questions. David Termina, ripping it up on Twitter. And Jennifer Grove, thank you very much. We'll see you all next week, and have a great weekend.
Take care, everybody.
Take care.